Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi. For your free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down, when you're strange.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today to talk about two films out in theaters, we have Michael Snydell.
Hello.
Hello. We also have Bill Graham.
Woo!
I am still struggling not to call you Will Graham because my rewatch of Hannibal is ongoing. And oh. I just want to be able to perfect Mads Mikkelsen's voice, so every time I throw to you, I can say, and what were your thoughts on this film, Will?
keep working on that.
I will.
Did we all hear that Brian Fuller actually exited the Star Trek miniseries?
Yeah, EP now,
show?
Isn't he?
Yeah, he's just got his name on.
My interest
more on American Gods.
I mean, I guess, but he's also co-director on American Gods, so my interest in Star Trek just completely tanked. So
I never had any interest. Yeah. And I was going to say, speaking of having no interest, but that seems overly cruel, we have a third guest on today, and that is Jordan Raup, our benevolent
Lord
and Master.
I'm glad to be so appreciated on here, guys.
We love
it. His introduction was super smooth.
You and everything you do for us. So today we're going to be talking about Doctor Strange in a mini review to kick the episode off. And then we're going to go into a full, giant, spoiler-filled review of Hacksaw Ridge. That is the newest film by Mel Gibson, who has been let out of director jail. And we will see what he did with his parole.
Even though
only
nobody
for two and a half hours.
Did no one see it? I haven't paid any attention to the numbers.
It made like $14 million, which is, I don't think it was the most expensive movie ever. So,
no,
I mean, given how violent it is,
I think that's still Avatar. yeah. Oh God, guys, I can't wait to talk about Hacksaw Ridge. I did not see Doctor Strange, so I will be conspicuously silent during the first part. I'm sure that our audience and fans' hearts are breaking at the news, but
oh,
that's
man.
Just how it is sometimes. I know. I know. I'm sorry, Bill.
You're
sitting here. I'm here, Brian, to replace you.
you're here to replace me. Oh, man.
Sorry, Dave. I can't do that.
All right. Well, before we get into everything, let me remind everyone that you can find us on Twitter at Film Stage Show, Facebook, search for The Film Stage Show. You can email us at podcasts@thefilmstage.com. In addition to that, we just got done with Halloween, and we all know what that means. Christmas is right around the corner. And
no!
what could be
there's at least one other holiday before that.
Nope, but not true. What could be a better gift for the podcast that you love than going onto iTunes and giving us a comment and a rating? Let us know how we're doing, give us some stars. It helps people find us, and it helps us to know how we're doing. Though I think we're doing pretty fucking amazing, so hopefully you agree. Now, before we get into everything else, I want to talk to you fine people at home about Mubi. Jordan, this is the first time that you've been on that you've gotten to experience the live Mubi plug, isn't it?
Yeah, it's thrilling.
Oh,
and the
man.
Tagline, right? And the great tagline.
You brought a tagline, right, Jordan?
I forgot.
You've been... Oh, God. Another week, another lack of a tagline for Mubi. Anyway, Mubi is the curated streaming cinema that gives you your choice of 30 films to watch. Now, the thing about Mubi is every day they introduce a new film and you have 30 days to watch it. So there's always something new to watch on Mubi. You can download these things right to your phone or your iPad so you can watch them on the go. So after the election happens and you begin your mad flight to Canada to escape the Trumpist regime, even when you're not by Wi-Fi, while you're crossing the frozen border to the north, you will still be able to watch a retrospective. Not a retrospective. you will still be able to watch Breaking News by Johnny Toe.
Woo!
Yeah!
And Full-Time Killer, another Johnny Toe.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's a collab, I think.
I don't think you guys talked about it last week, but they added Infernal Affairs, which is the basis for The Departed.
Oh, yeah.
They did. No, last week we were still jonesing over their horrific October. That is over, but those films are still on there. So if you would still like to ask the pig, you still have 20 days to watch Calvaire or Calvary or whatever. I don't know how to say it. And no one in the movie said it. So.
And they have Nosferatu as well, right?
Yeah.
It's still up there?
Yeah.
Yep.
Nosferatu, you got 17 days. These are ticking clocks, people. So if you have a love of ticking clocks and awesome movies, Mubi is the place for you. We are giving you a 30-day trial. Go to mubi.com/filmstage, and you can get your free 30-day trial and understand the glory for your own self. And also, maybe you can throw us a tagline. Mubi, tagline forthcoming. All right. That is it. That's all that we had to do before we could talk about these beautiful, lovely, wonderful, wholesome films. So let's start off completely non-controversial films. Let's start off with Doctor Strange, the newest film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I was going to start reeling off some of the cast
many?
List and stuff, but I realized that on IMDb, if you don't spell out the word doctor, you get Doctor Strange from 1978, and I pulled it up, and I was like, I don't recognize any of these people, so
let me actually go
to the right Doctor Strange. And that is directed by Scott Derrickson and stars Benedict Cumberbatch, Chitwell Ejiofor, Rachel McAdams, Benedict Wong, and of course, Tilda Swinton, plus Lecter himself, Mads Mikkelsen.
There we go.
Also a serious man himself.
Oh, yeah.
Bill feels super excited now. All right, here is the trailer for Doctor Strange.
You think you know how the world works? You think that this material universe is all there is? But what if I told you the reality you know is one of many?
What the? This doesn't make any sense.
Not everything has to, Doctor Strange. Through the mystic arts, we harness energy and shape reality.
The Avengers protect the world from physical dangers. We safeguard it against more mystical threats.
Come with me.
A man named Strange, a woman named Tilda, and mystical threats to our world. What could be better? Let's talk about it. Let's give Jordan the first go at this. We will be saying that this is not a spoiler review, so this will all be general basic thoughts, overall things. So Jordan Raup, what did you think of the newest entry into the MCU, Doctor Strange?
Sure, yeah. So Doctor Strange, yeah. Scott Derrickson, and an interesting director, I think, to pick. Mostly comes from like a horror/thriller background, so doing kind of a bigger scale here, I was hoping, you know, for that kind of vibe in some aspects. And yeah, so with Doctor Strange, definitely the best cast I think Marvel's had so far. But I was a little disappointed in it, to be honest. I think visually, for sure, like the different, you know, I mean, it feels like he's kind of, there's a lot of different scenes where it's almost like floating through like the most elaborate, expensive screensaver that you've ever seen. And those sections are really cool. And there's some really cool visual ideas going on in that. And I really obviously love Tilda Swinton, who kind of brings this kind of, I said in my review, icy swagger to her role. And there's a few conversations with her that are great. And she really sells her character, I think. But yeah, overall, I think one of the issues here is it's yet another origin story for Marvel. And while we shouldn't kind of deride them from doing that because they have so many more characters to introduce, this one kind of just feels a little stale in the end. I feel like They don't do that many new interesting things with what, you know, this is definitely the most fantastical world they've had yet. And sorry if there's an alarm going. It's New York City. I don't know if you hear that.
Is that an alarm or is that a siren?
Like, I mean, a siren.
Are they coming to get you?
Okay. They are. It's Marvel. It's
not enough praise. Not enough praise.
Exactly. So I think I actually reviewed it for the site. I gave it like a C+. I think, like I said, like the world they create is pretty interesting in the sense of just visually there's something engaging going on, I think, pretty much the entire movie. But yeah, I was just really let down by the, you know, everything rests on kind of Benedict Cumberbatch's shoulders. And I think they try to strike this tone between having him be kind of this arrogant asshole and then having just filled to the brim with jokes. I told one of my friends that it kind of feels like there's someone in the writing room and on set every time making sure that every single moment of like a Marvel movie is as fun as possible. And when you're trying to do like an anti-hero, like kind of like this, and there's no kind of moments for kind of getting darker into, you know, what makes his psyche up and what makes him interesting. And you're just trying to kind of have jokes, like no one in this film except for kind of Tilda Swinton kind of seems to take the material that seriously. So it kind of feels like it's, you know, fun, of course, and it's an easy way to pass the time, but it didn't really hit me in the way I was hoping it would. So yeah, an improvement over Civil War for sure, but yeah, not the best Marvel outing.
All right, Michael Snydell.
Jordan, I'm in somewhat the same camp as you, in the sense of I would definitely say that this is probably the best superhero movie we got this year. You know, not that that's a, you know, a huge achievement, but you know what I'd say about this is, yeah, the screensaver comment is definitely one that stuck with me, because in the moment I was, you know, feeling that spectacle. But I think you know, the art design, you know, it's like an M.C. Escher, it's like a you know, a Salvador Dali, and then, you know, the big movie that people are comparing this to is Inception, in the way that the architecture literally, you know, folds over itself. But the problem with that is that even compared to something like Inception, it's hard not to get the sense that these worlds are very sterile. And there are, you know, there are some action set pieces where, you know, you are seeing characters like Doctor Strange and, you know, a good old Mads chasing each other around worlds where they need to adapt. But in a lot of cases, it does feel very, very static. And, you know, going along with Civil War, this is another Marvel film that seems to, like, you know, set up some interesting ideas about, you know, faith in science and some interesting ideas, especially with the relationship. I won't say that there's anything really that memorable, but I will say that there are hints of more complex, like, ethical ideas in here. And like Civil War, it essentially is simplified down to, you know, let's punch each other as hard as we can. So I guess what I'd say about this is it's not really anything new for Marvel. The performances are fine. The one thing I will say is why this feels a little different to me is surprisingly, Marvel's done a pretty good job in preparing us for worlds that are a lot less grounded. You know, you look at something like Guardians of the Galaxy, you look at something like Age of Ultron, which is not something I liked very much, but all of these films are actually pretty good stepping stones for what I've been told. I don't know a lot about Infinity War, the next Avengers, obviously, but I've been told that the source material is very, you know, it's cosmic forces and it's metaphysical realms and things like that. And so as much as Doctor Strange is kind of a okay experience overall, I think it is actually hinting at a world that feels more comic booky for lack of better words. So that's the one thing I would say, that I do think this feels a little bit different than, you know, even something like a Civil War.
Pardon me. All right, Bill Graham.
So I have to come at this from a different angle. First off, I want to mention something that I've kind of been running with in my head, and I don't know if anybody has kind of capitalized on it or anything like that, but basically it seems like all the introduction Marvel films, whether it's Captain America, whether it's Thor, whether it's Ant-Man, Iron Man, things like this, they all pretty much run about 2 hours or less. It's right at that mark. And this one is, according to Wiki, it is 115 minutes. So it's about 5 minutes under that 2 hour runtime. And it seems like the second iteration. So let's take Captain America, the Winter Soldier. That is 136 minutes, right? So it's 16 minutes longer. Civil War is 147 minutes. We can look at Guardians of the Galaxy and see that that is what it is. The Avengers, kind of the meet-up films.
Audience, once again, how important movie times are to Bill Graham.
Yes, yes, indeed. So it all seems like the introduction is always kind of the initial hook. And once they have you, they're like, okay, you're going to show up for the next film, and you're not going to mind that it's like close to 2.5 hours, right? You're not going to mind as much because you're already invested in those characters, and you're fucking sitting down for the second movie. Like they already know they have you. Like there's no guesswork in this, right? So this film does a lot to set up everything, and I think what Michael was saying is very, very important, in that this is basically Marvel's Green Lantern film that is super cosmic, that is super just like expanding the boundaries and all this. But that film came at a time when there was no DC cinematic universe. It was just like, hey guys, y'all ready to go to space? And people were like, whoa, what the fuck is going on? Here, it's like, no, we've watched invaders from out of our world come into New York City and just wreck shop. Right, we've seen the Guardians be out in the in space and kind of bring some of this cosmic. We've seen Thor. We've understood like Asgard is in a different world. It's in like kind of a different universe and everything like that. So we have been kind of spoon fed to this point where this is not a film that's just going to blow people's minds. It is a gradual progression that has happened over God knows how many. I have all of the fucking like individual films like up on my web browser right now, and it's crowded, right? So it's like, holy shit, how many films, how many hours have we already devoted to this Marvel Cinematic Universe? And here's one that's just going to kind of expand it just a little bit. That being said, I really enjoyed the visuals. I think a lot of people have already mentioned this. And yes, there is kind of an Inception vibe and in how it's just kind of breaking. It's breaking our mind in a little bit, but it's mainly it's breaking, it's breaking the main character's mind over and over and over. And what they do so intelligently, I think, is they take that moment where he's kind of this non-believer and they fast forward it. They fast forward it. I don't know. It's probably 6-7 months in the middle of the film where all of a sudden you go from him being kind of a non-believer and kind of like trying to figure it out to all of a sudden he's checking out books like the librarian's like, whoa, you're advancing pretty fast.
It honestly seems like it could be 3 weeks too.
No
markers.
No, you don't have any kind of clue, like except for the snazzy kind of like look and you know, he's got his goatee on point. But besides that, you don't really know like what's going on in his life. So it is interesting that it does that. Again, the visuals are amazing, but I actually have to say my biggest criticism for the film as a whole isn't necessarily narratively, because I think all of these are just kind of – all of these origin films are usually softballs, right? They're usually – hey, let's throw something out there. It's easy to grasp. It's easy to just kind of say that was enjoyable, that was fun, and this film is certainly funny and it's fun. But I actually have to say the action in this film was pretty lousy. There are some moments, obviously, with the visuals and things like that that are just fantastic. And unfortunately, I actually didn't see this film in 3D. And there's definitely moments when I could tell certain sequences and certain moments would definitely benefit from the 3D element.
Yeah, the 3D was definitely good, I would say.
Yeah, and I've heard that over and over. I've heard that this is one of those few films where people were like, hey, y'all should probably go see this in 3D.
Just to be a quick dissenting on the 3D, I was not particularly impressed with the 3D.
Oh, so you actually saw it in 3D?
I did, yeah. I thought it was too dark.
Well, what else?
Well, I mean, that's
that could be a theater. Yeah,
that's universal. Yeah.
The scene, I won't spoil it, but the scene like with the apple, I thought was interesting the way they portrayed that in 3D.
I would agree with that, yes. There were moments.
Like in my, I don't know if it was too dark for you, but in my screening, like I could literally pick out, like when the cities were folding on top of each other, like way in the distance, different like cars driving and signposts, and I thought that was kind of cool. The depth of field I thought was really well done.
Yeah, I would agree, but there's just I did notice I took off my glasses a couple times weirdly, and is there only parts of the film that are shot in 3D? Maybe I'm being very ignorant.
None of it was shot. It's all post-converted 3D.
Yeah, oh, it was all post-converted.
Okay.
Yep. Well, I think the lesson here is, Michael, quit going to shitty theaters.
I wanted to know, is there a reason hopefully why it was post-converted and not just shot in 3D? Is post-conversion just
is it money?
I mean, no, well, for example, like, I mean, Gravity was post-converted. Like, I think that when 3D was first coming out, like, right after Avatar, I think there was this huge derision, and for good reason, for post-converted, because it had this, you know, it was synonymous with fast, cheap, and doing it right after the film's done. But I think nowadays, when they're pre-planning these films years in advance, there's no difference, really, that I've seen. So
okay.
Yeah, I think it just depends on the execution.
What was it? Clash of the Titans was post-converted, and people were like, it looks like cardboard cutouts.
Are you talking about Gods of Egypt?
No,
that what you're saying? Oh.
I'm literally talking about Clash of the Titans.
Okay, never mind.
I think they made that decision like 6 weeks before it came out, so it was like awful.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
Wow. Yeah, I have to say, I'm actually one of the few people, in particular on this podcast, that actually likes the MCU action. I think like something like Captain America Civil War, I think the action, having seen that film, I think 3 times now in theaters, I think the action like actually really, really holds up in it, and it has a fluidity
charm to it. I loved the action on that, so you're not alone.
I did too.
Okay. Oh,
yeah,
wow.
You're definitely
okay.
Not alone then.
What did you think of the choreography in this one?
That is my main criticism against this film is, holy shit, at times it is just a complete and utter blur, likes of which I usually like cringe for most modern cinematic kind of action blockbuster. Like it was to the point where you would see edits and you would see quick flashes and you would see like a punch and you'd be like, what? Who the fuck punched?
You definitely got the sense that Marvel was like, all right, guys, here's the visual effects for this world. Now do what you can in these shots. And it wasn't the other way around.
Yeah.
Like when people are jumping around and stuff like that, there's no.
Yeah, it's.
I will say, though, to defend one aspect of it, I do think, not to spoil it, but I did appreciate the final battle being almost about anti-destruction.
Yes, and that's one thing I kind of wanted to touch on is the world that this film kind of established. It actually makes a decent amount of sense in the fact that, like, okay, this is obviously fake and this is obviously some kind of, like, you know, bullshit world, but the rules that they kind of establish, and I like that the characters in the world itself respect the rules that they're trying to set up, they're actually trying to make sure that people don't break certain rules and they don't do certain things. And that all ends up playing into kind of the final confrontation. It kind of plays into the whole film as a whole. And I really feel like that is something that a lot of people kind of aren't latching onto and kind of appreciating enough. I mean, the visuals themselves are outstanding. And I think this film, definitely, Jordan, you mentioned it feels like kind of a split personality with the Doctor Strange. And honestly, like, I was cringing in the first half of this film when they're trying to set up Strange as this just kind of egotistical asshole. And I was just like, holy shit, how are they going to round back on this? Because this guy is completely irredeemable for most of this film. And I don't even think they really achieve him being redeemed at any point in this film whatsoever. But just the same, it's fun to watch this guy that is an unbeliever become a believer just the same. So
I always think,
Jordan, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, in terms of like casting, I said in my review how like it kind of felt strange how everyone kind of felt like really bored to me, at least in their roles, like except for maybe Tilda Swinton. Like because originally it was supposed to be Joaquin Phoenix, at least briefly he was in talks. Sure. And so I just think of like someone where it almost feels like a fish out of water for what they're doing. And plus that might have gone well with the comedic tone, whereas Benedict Cumberbatch like pretty much takes everything insanely serious in this film. And there's just like these different gags, like one with Beyonce and like another one about like correcting his name and different things that the only kind of comedic touches I really thought worked well was the with his cloak, because that kind of feels intertwined with the universe and part of it. But the other stuff feels very much like Marvel notes to like make the scene funnier and stuff like that.
Yeah,
so
what it feels like, and I don't know how much, you know, behind baseball this kind of stuff is, but it feels like punch up work. That's what those kind of sequences feel like. And if you don't know what punch up work is, basically a lot of these films that are made now, they basically the scripts are handed over to comedians to basically add some punch, add some comedy to these films. And those specific moments feel very out of left field. They certainly worked, like specifically for my audience, they were all laughing and giggling and having a good time, but it feels so out of left field specifically for this director that I guess we have to kind of mention Derrickson's previous work. You did mention it at the kind of top, but yeah, he's definitely most known for Sinister, I think, at this point. Hopefully not so much the day the Earth stood still.
So I guess wrapping up, what is everyone's like? Was someone getting attacked by a ninja?
Sorry, I had to cough and I muted mid cough.
So what is everyone's final?
Brian, can I,
like,
I just want to respond to that. What Bill was saying real quick.
You can't have nice things. All right,
this is true. What I'd say about that mythology, Bill, is that like I think the reason why I have trouble wanting to give it that full credit is just that for every good idea it comes up with, it either doesn't follow through on it or it muddles it to the point where okay, you had an interesting like to be general but more specific, you know, like the inner conflict between faith and science, and you know how he views his own mortality, like that is a subject that would be interesting if that was honed in on. But then I feel like that's piled on or it's further muddled, and I don't really understand the motives of some of these characters, especially by the end.
Especially in the post-credit sequence.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think this is honestly the failing of kind of, and I mentioned it at the top, and that's why I mentioned it, is it almost feels cookie cutter in the sense that these films, these introduction films, all have to be 2 hours or less. That's pretty much across the board, that's what they have to be. And I feel like this film in particular was trying to stuff a lot of things in that 2 hour or less runtime. And I feel like there's probably 20 minutes kind of on the cutting floor that would probably benefit this film, but for general audiences would probably leave them a little bit stranded. So I honestly think this is another film that definitely, if you enjoy the MCU so far, this is definitely something that you have to see.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to not having to talk about superhero films until March.
Logan, I was going to say,
oh
you're
my
like...
God, Jordan, can we? I could spend like a full hour just talking about the Logan trailer because I've seen it twice.
For the
now,
love of God, let's not do that.
And it is. I just want to say, like, it has almost made me cry each time I've watched that trailer.
How much of that is Johnny Cash though, and how much of that is Wolverine?
So much Johnny Cash.
I think it's a combination of Hugh Jackman looking old and beat up, Johnny yep. Cash, and like the father-daughter Johnny relationship Cash. They seem to be building, but also that soulful, like chronically ill Patrick Stewart. Like there are just moments in that trailer that I guess as a new father are designed to devastate me. But I mean,
I kind of love how that movie looks like it takes place in like one field. I'm kind of excited
exactly.
for that.
Yeah, it looks like a one location. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not going to be, but I want it to be.
I know.
It's
just
I don't know.
A standoff, just a good old Mexican standoff.
Oh man.
What is that movie, Free Fire, but with Logan? Yeah. In it. Exactly. But yeah, no, I'm actually kind of excited for that movie. So yeah.
That'll be the next superhero movie you talk about. Also, it will be the next one I think coming out, so
That's fine with me. I'm good with that. All right, well, let's move on from superheroes to decorated war heroes. The next film... That wasn't a joke. The next film that we're talking about is Hacksaw Ridge. This is the newest film from Mel Gibson. And it is the true story of Desmond Doss, who won the Medal of Honor despite being a conscientious objector.
Brad, and you missed the chance to say real-life Captain America.
Damn.
That would have been your...
He's not a captain, though.
Oh, Jesus.
Forget it.
I guess neither was Captain America, right?
Anyway, I'm unappreciated.
So this stars Andrew Garfield and I'm just going to say Vince Vaughn because I don't want to go through the entire cast, and I think it's weird that Vince Vaughn is in this movie. Here is the trailer.
What the hell is your delay, Captain?
We're waiting, sir.
Waiting for what?
Private Doss.
Who the hell is Private Doss?
I always dreamed about being a doctor, but didn't get much school. I can't stay here while all them go fight for me.
What, you figure this war is just going to fit in with your ideas?
While everybody else is taking life, I'm gonna be saving it.
And that's gonna be my way to serve.
This is a personal gift from the United States government designed to bring death to the enemy.
Well, I'm sorry, Sergeant. I can't touch a gun.
You don't kill.
No, sir.
You know, quite a bit of killing does occur in war.
Private Doss does not believe in violence.
So that is the trailer for Hacksaw Ridge, in which a young man who wishes to be an army medic has made a personal vow not to pick up a gun during the course of World War II and has to struggle with the way that keeps him from integrating into the army, and then, later on, how it keeps him from being able to operate on the field of battle. So, newest
Brian,
tweet.
You have to go first, Brian. We all talked about a movie already.
I hate going first.
You're technically going fourth, so...
I guess. I kind of mentally reset the clock whenever we jump to a new movie. So, Hacksaw Ridge is a bundle of contradictions. Mainly because it is a movie that is very much pro-life, anti-war, and very much on the side of Private Doss in terms of, you know, we shouldn't be killing each other, and it's a lot better and more noble to try to save life in the midst of all this. At the same time, it opens with a slow motion, like, ballet scene of people being shot and burned and exploded, and I've never seen so many people twirling in the air during a war film. You would think that there was some wuxia martial arts going on, but really it's just people being concussed because of numerous explosions.
So many limbs. The most limbs I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah, so... And Mel Gibson, all personal failings aside, and Lord knows he has many, is a very, very good director, especially for this kind of film. And it's impossible for him not to make the violence aesthetically pleasing, I guess is the best way to put it. It's very clear that his intention is to show the horror of war in detail that is sometimes stomach-turning. But he's too good of a director, and it is super compelling to watch this. Now, that being said, if you can get over the mental hump, I think there's a lot here to enjoy. But a brief anecdote just to illustrate, I guess, my full feelings on this movie. So the movie opens, and it's very much like a Hallmark Channel, like faith-based romance film. Because you have a young boy who hurts his brother and fixates on the Ten Commandments, and he has a bad home life.
Cain and Abel.
Very religious. What was that?
It's like a Cain and Abel adaptation.
Yeah. So he very much finds solace in the Bible and is very, very firm in his faith. And then he meets this woman who's a nurse at the hospital in his town, and they have the cutest, most adorable, like almost screwball courtship. And then he's like, you know, I gotta go to war. My brother's going, all these other people, and it wouldn't be right for me not to go. You know, I wanna serve my country. And so then it becomes kind of like a Yankee Doodle Dandy story of this tiny kid deciding to go to war, but only wanting to help people during it, which is noble. And then he kind of comes afoul of all of his power structures, and he has to fight for his faith and in his conviction. And around the time that, like, there's a court-martial scene, I think to myself, you know, I could, like, definitely tell my parents to go see this movie. And thank God. Thank God that there's not a moment in a movie where it stops and is like, hey, if you've enjoyed it so far, you should tell your people to go see it. Because shortly after that, when they get to the actual war, the tonal shift in this film is staggering. And I think that if you're not ready for that, like, if you think that this is going to stay, like, maybe on the level of the pre-code films that it seems to be going for, that change is going to shock you in a way that you will not be able to recover from.
Yeah. You know how in most films, there's, like, a second unit that does the action? It feels like in this film, there was a second unit that did all the drama, and then Mel Gibson just did all the action.
Yeah, Mel Gibson is, like, deep in this shit, getting ready for the war scenes, and meanwhile, his, like, DP just has to mid-shot some of the romance scenes.
Exactly.
But, I mean, it goes from, like, a 1930s to 1950s, like, socially conscious romance to a 2016 war film, and the change is signaled through a jump scare very quickly followed by a juicy gunshot wound to the head, and I was just like, okay, this is all different now, like, everything has changed. And from that point on, it's a super compelling film, but it really does feel like you got up to go to the bathroom and walked into the wrong theater. And I think that is something the movie has to grapple with, because this starts off like a Disney film, like Miracle or something, and then just and then just head dives into the pits of hell, but in an aesthetically compelling way that makes it difficult to really continue to hold on to the convictions that the movie is throwing at you. But that being said, I enjoyed this film. I thought that all of the performances ranged from good to quite good or very good. And I was compelled the entire way through. And it's the rare film that opens like towards the end and then has like the flashback to 16 years later that I'm not, this time I wasn't annoyed by it. And when we got kind of back to that point and I could tell that I was where the movie had begun, I was so engrossed in the story that I'd forgotten that the movie even began that way. So, yeah, that's my basic thoughts. Hacksaw Ridge.
Wait, so did you recommend this to your parents, Brian? You
never I haven't talked to them yet. But I mean, it's just so weird because, like, my parents watched Saving Private Ryan. Like, they're fine with that violence, but, like, I don't know how to prepare them. Because no matter what I say, and, like, they've seen Braveheart, they know what Mel Gibson can do. But no matter what you tell someone, the movie will distract you from that reality up until the point that it sprays in your face like blowback from a gunshot wound. And it's going to be hard for a lot of people to get over that hump. So there's that. I just don't know. But this is definitely a movie I'd recommend. And yeah, I guess we can get into the themes and the plot more later. But yeah, I'm interested what you guys thought. So Michael Snydell, you're actually the reason we decided to make this the full review, because you had a response to it that I found enigmatic and interesting. So why don't you tell us what you thought?
Wait, what was my response?
I don't even remember. You said something like it was crazy or, oh boy, this movie.
I guess I'm gonna, you know, kind of repeat some of what you're saying in the sense of, you know, it's a very throttling experience in terms of the tonal dissonance between these two halves. The best description I can come up with for the violence, and this doesn't even describe the visual style, but, you know, it's like the fever pitch of violence in Inglourious Basterds is like the starting point for this for the war scenes in this movie. I guess what I'd say about it is I think I probably found the first half more, to speak directly to your feelings, Brian, I think I probably found the first half a lot more of a slog than you. I thought that romance was fine, but I'm gonna say something very strange here. Teresa Palmer, I actually thought she had a more interesting romance in The Choice a little bit earlier this year.
Okay, so you saw The Choice?
I did, and I kind of liked it.
The movie that caused Nicholas Sparks to shut down his production company.
Guys, it's the best Nicholas Sparks movie since probably The Notebook, so I'm just saying.
What am I hearing? What is happening right now?
All right, well, I don't think I've seen any of his
review.
Anyways, the point... This is a weird self-promotion. I guess what I want to say about this is, some of that the combination of piety and, you know, aw shunks, charisma, and, you know, just like, you know, Andrew Garfield doing these, you know, baby face, like antiquated courtship. Like it was interesting for a bit, but man, it goes on for a long time.
Charming.
as we kind of hit, it feels a lot more, a good amount of this film actually feels a lot more like a biopic than a war film, which I guess is, you know, fair. Cause obviously it's the story of, Desmond Doss, but it is, I just didn't find the dialogue that interesting in that first half. You know, it's weird. Andrew Garfield's performance in here reminded me of Jeff Bridges in Starman. At first, I was like, "All right, you're just a little bit too socially awkward. Like this is a little bit too much."
Actually, I actually had a similar problem at the outset because okay. As we all remember from me talking about Moonlight, I have a real problem with characters who can't express themselves, even if that's part of their character. And I was like, if this guy doesn't learn how to speak in a complete sentence, I'm gonna kill myself. But luckily, he starts to grow in his eloquence, so I was able to ease away from that.
So,
I thought my buddy while I was watching it leaned over and he goes, "Is he special?" And I was just like, "Oh no!"
He's just country folk.
The thing that was most the most interesting part of that is not necessarily the father's character, but what the father believes about Andrew Garfield's character. You know, what is interesting about this obviously is that it's not only the pacifism, but the fact that we're getting a different view of the battlefield. One that's based on not passivity, but it's a very different form of action. And so, you know, there's a really interesting conversation he has with his father early on where he says something about, how there's impulsive people and there's cautious people, in terms of who will be the people who will be the first to enlist. And so I found his guilt or to want to enlist, kind of interesting. And I think that is the element that's most interesting, especially once he ends up in boot camp and it goes further. But again, yeah, last thoughts is just that, it's just such a tonal shift in the second half. And that second half is just astounding in the way it just makes, you're talking about twirling bodies. Like it's like a tableaus of, limbs. And it's just, it's truly astounding. My jaw was on the floor.
I just remembered what that made me think of. Did you all see Across the Universe?
Yes.
Okay. Remember the scene where the girl's singing, "I Want to Hold Your Hand," and she's walking through the football players who were like hitting each other and flying through the air and flipping each other over in slow motion? That's what the battle scenes made me think of, but with a lot more screaming and blood. Jordan Rock, what did you think of Hacksaw Ridge?
So to bring up another comparison that you said earlier, Michael, at like any point in this movie, I feel like it's only like two steps removed from the propaganda film in Inglourious Basterds, or like, or like a fake movie, the fake movie that Robert Downey Jr. is doing in Tropic Thunder, like something like that. But surprisingly, it works. I think, like I said, like you guys have kind of said, the first half is very by the numbers standard kind of shot with this like. The period setting actually looks fake. Like it looks like someone's imagination of what it would look like.
Their uniforms don't look that good either.
It feels like a production, like a stage production in some aspects. But anyways, once it hits, shit hits the fan, it definitely will grab you a hold and not let go for sure. I would say like in terms of the performances, I actually thought Andrew Garfield was like really great in this. I think he, just kind of like the, like you guys brought up a little bit, like the passive stoicism of like not, adhering to the norm and things like that. I think it's really interesting. And in many ways, which we can dive into, this almost feels like a remake of The Passion of the Christ in terms of his trajectory and different shots that Mel Gibson uses. There's just so many allegories I picked up on.
Flogging scene in particular was...
No. So, and then there's the whole thing with Vince Vaughn, just to talk about. Half the time I thought he worked, then at the other half it was like kind of the most like unbelievable Joel Sargent I've seen in a while.
To that point, I mean, something I wanted to bring up is when I was describing this movie to my wife, I said, it's not even like they're lacking for opportunity for violence and like their R rating in the beginning. Because, I swear to God, the first hour of this movie is PG rated. Even Vince Vaughn's drill sergeant,
The first scene where he is, gets the opportunity to help someone, it's certainly a Mel Gibson movie from there. The you see the bone, I think, sticking out of the person and blood spurting. Yeah.
But,
I was like, oh, here we go.
Yeah, that's not PG.
I guess, but, I could see, the ratings board looking at that and being like, well, it shows that he was in danger and he was helping him and blah, blah, blah. It didn't feel that crazy, but, even the boot camp scene, they have Vince Vaughn as the drill sergeant, and, no one's really cursing that much, and, all the characters are your typical stock characters, and they, give each other shit, but, no one's calling anyone any, really awful names, and even, when they decide they're gonna, haze DOS, it's not, Full Metal Jacket style. It feels, again, like a Mighty Ducks movie. There's a real lack of danger or reality to it. And I think Vince Vaughn is part of that. Not that I didn't like him in this movie, but it was a decision that seemed to be made by someone who's like, well, we don't want this to be too rough, so let's get Vince Vaughn to do it, and he can maybe cut it.
Potentially
with a little of that
could
comedy.
Be. I mean, I don't know if that was intentional in the sense of Gibson trying to say real life, even the worst things I could have in real life is nothing compared to the shit that you're gonna see over here.
Mm-hmm. That's possible.
But or it could be because that's the tone he wanted to do, and it's kind of cheesy, his other
films.
It's
hard to know in this movie, how much of it was well, what can I do to make war seem super bad? And it's well, let's have it be Ozzie and Harriet meets House of a Thousand Corpses. you really
do
want
to Texas Chainsaw, but yeah,
you really do want to draw that distinction, but it's so weird.
It's interesting. It is co-written by the a guy who wrote The Pacific. So I don't know if I assume it's because he wrote the Pacific is why he got the gig.
Yeah, I would assume he would have a deeper knowledge of the Pacific Theater and the things that went on there.
I'm ready to talk.
Yeah, is Jordan done?
Well, I definitely want to talk more about in-depth stuff, so when we get into spoilers, I'll return.
All right, awesome. Well, then, yeah, Bill, now that Jordan has actually signaled that he's done his general thoughts, why don't you let us know what you thought?
Okay, so this film, to me, feels like four parts. I don't know if y'all saw my Facebook post, but I basically did. Mentioned it feels like four parts, and the four parts are very distinct. They're very different. I actually really enjoyed the love story. I really enjoy Palmer in this role, Teresa Palmer. I really don't think she's gotten enough work.
She's great.
She's like dinner plates.
Yeah, she is
classic
fantastic
Hollywood,
in this film.
Wide-eyed.
In the choice, guys.
God damn it. You
okay,
know what? When
moving
we're in the doldrums,
on.
When we're in the doldrums right, in January,
I'm
we
done,
can all watch
I'm done,
The Choice.
I'm done.
That'll be our drunk movie.
Okay. So I really enjoyed that love story. And yes, he is kind of a little special. He is a little slow at first. I think part of that we start to realize is part of the abuse by his father. And I think there is a sequence when his brother basically... I don't know if this is too much of a spoiler, but his brother basically at a dinner sequence shows up in full army garb and is like, hey, I'm signing up for the military. Bye, guys. And his father gives this strange, crazy speech where he basically gets out of his own accent. He's playing this kind of southern.
Yeah, Hugo
drunk.
Weaving. So weird. Yeah. That was such a weird scene.
Yeah.
It was a weird performance.
It's such a weird performance, but because it breaks him in that sequence, his accent breaks, everything just seems completely foreign. For me, it worked extremely well.
I'm glad you said that, because I really do think that was a choice he was making to go back to shell shock. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the fuck, who he was funneling or, trying to imitate in that moment. But holy crap, that moment really kind of sold the film for me from that point on. I enjoyed the love story and kind of the cuteness of it, but I really think that whole sequence really, really sold me on the film to where I was willing to go wherever it was going to go. The war sequences are probably the most vivid and intense things I've ever witnessed in my life. This is just completely next level, particularly the introduction of once they crest this mountain ridge, it's whatever. Yeah, whatever they're calling it, right?
How would you possibly know that, Brian?
This isn't a Kubo in the Two Strings moment. It's a ridge.
Oh, no.
Let's not go there. anyways, so they crest this, and within 5 minutes, just shit hits the fan. And again, my stomach was just churning throughout. I think this is definitely a film, if you can stomach it, it is really enjoyable. But if you cannot stomach it, please do not watch this film in the middle of a theater, because you're probably going to be crowded. You're probably not going to be able to escape very quickly. And yeah, I don't want to have to give you like a, yeah, I don't want to give you a chum bucket. Like,
did anybody have walkouts? I'm just curious.
No, actually, my theater,
there was like 10 people in my theater, so no.
My theater was fairly full, and it was a very like mixed crowd, you know, old, young, black, white, male, women. And no, everyone stuck around, and everyone seemed to like it. There was applause after it was done.
Yeah,
same.
I think what they did well early on was, A, this film is a Mel Gibson film, so I guess people already kind of knew a little bit what to expect. You know, it was like, oh, it's a war film, and it's by Mel Gibson. Oh, okay. I understand what that means,
You've
right?
seen Braveheart. You know what this means.
Yeah. I think it was also fairly well set up that this film was rated R, even though, like Brian was saying, it feels like a Hallmark movie kind of from the outset, and you're just like, what is this movie? I don't understand where like, I don't understand how they're going to transition, and they're like, no, don't worry, we're just going to pull the emergency brake and just like hard right, and you're just like, oh, okay, I guess that was a choice. I gotta say, when Vince Vaughn comes in and he's automatically cursing and just being a dickhole throughout the entire time that he's kind of on screen, I was just like, what movie is he in? Because he's setting it up like, I get it. Like, they're over here in America and they're training to go over and battle, like specifically in Okinawa and like all this shit. But it's like, His level of just like antagonism towards all of his troops from the very beginning just feels like, wait, dude, like can you ease into this, or is this just like you 100% all the way?
Well, there is a war going on, so I assume
I had a friend who was in the Marines, and we had a party for him his last night before he went off to basic. And of course, as any party where a friend is going to the Marines is, we had to watch the drill sergeant scenes from Full Metal Jacket just to be like, hey man, hope you're looking forward to this. And in that movie, you know, it basically begins the same way. Arlie Ermey just busts in and is immediately an asshole to everyone. And apparently, what my friend told me when he got back after a while was that part of that is for unit cohesion. Because you're going to have a lot of guys from a lot of different places who might not all have like the same experience. But if you can make them hate someone immediately, then they suddenly have one very real thing in common. Even if that thing is, oh my God, this drill sergeant's a huge asshole. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, I never heard that.
Holy shit, that actually makes a lot of sense.
Well, that comes through a little bit in an opposite sense in terms of, you know, them all being against Doss at the beginning as well.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's one of the reasons why they dislike him so much and why the army is like, we have to get this guy out. Because unit cohesion is one of the most important things. And if you have people thinking that this guy is getting special treatment or isn't willing to fight for you, then shit's going to go bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think again, the initial war sequences are incredibly vivid. They're incredibly cinematic and just super intense and enthralling. And you just can't help but watch, even as limbs are blown off of legs and all this crazy shit is happening. Your eyes are just glued to the screen. And I think it kind of, I almost want to say it kind of loses its way the more it gets into DOS and his kind of role in this film. And it's nothing to take away from the actual DOS that actually lived, that actually saved these people's lives and things like that. But I think it almost gets into the hokey kind of Hallmark nature of the first half, where it starts to round back on itself, and it almost just completely kind of lost me at that moment. I think the film, what is it? This is a 2 hour...
And 11 minutes.
Yeah, 11 minutes. It feels much longer than that.
Oh, really?
It really does.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I have the opposite response. No. I thought...
Whoa, hold on. Who said yes?
I would agree.
Mike agrees.
Yes,
Jordan, do you agree?
No, I felt about what it was to me.
I thought that it was a lot faster. The only reason that it might have... What's the proper way to put this? A lot of movies will be very long and feel like it. A lot of movies will be very short and feel like it. Like, it feels like they packed in way too many things. This movie felt like it was shorter than it was, but it had more things than it had a right to, and it still balanced them well. Which I know is a very complicated sentence to parse.
Sure.
I apologize. But I guess I'll say it felt like a well-balanced film with a lot of...
As Roger Ebert said, no good movie is long enough, and no bad movie is short enough.
Yeah, this one struck the balance perfectly. So I guess it's a fine movie.
I would say that the way that the film progressed made me think that, all bets were off when it was actually going to end, or, how to actually, view those segments. I couldn't figure out a sense of, rhythm for the, once the battle scenes start and things like that. It's not like there's an obvious narrative in terms of understanding how those are going to evolve in the same way that it does, when he's back home and meeting his sweetheart and, everything like that. Like they're, and again, I guess that's something we've all kind of been wrestling with in our conversation is, I don't know whether it certainly makes it more interesting to talk about that. It is so, odd in its tonal shifts, but I don't know whether to view that as a flaw or whether this is just artistic intention. There are certainly moments you guys are referring to where, it sounds like he's very clearly, especially the way we get into the battle, in the sense we're inched in and then, thrown into the deep end. But at a certain point, I don't know how to actually... whether I can actually view that as a full artistic statement or whether it ends up feeling disjointed in my head.
I think it's a disjointed artistic statement, in all honesty. Like, there's a lot in this movie where it's like, I can tell you're doing this on purpose. I just don't know if it's a good idea.
Sure.
It's hard to know what a spoiler for this is because
it's
historical fiction. They're not, it's based on history, but I didn't know any of it. So,
Let me say one more thing and then we can jump into spoilers. How about that? Yeah. That work? Okay. I feel like this film, much like Birth of the Nation, just fucking ends. And I wasn't expecting when it ended for it to end at that point. So that's my one major kind of concern with this film is that it builds and it builds and it builds. And just like it kind of drops you into the middle of the war, it also just like picks you up and takes you right out of it. And just like, okay, we're done. And you're like, what? Am I going to see Teresa Palmer again? Like, what's going on in this film? And so, yeah, the film just kind of just ends, and you're just like, okay, cool. This is the time I clap. Okay, all right, I'll clap. You know, so yeah, I feel like this film just, I think that's part of my issue with its length is it feels too short, and yet it feels like it was long enough to not feel short. And I was just like, it's hard to grapple with those kind of mixed emotions where I'm like, hey, I thought you were going to give me more, and you actually gave me a lot of other stuff instead of the thing that I thought you were going to give me more of, you know? So
yeah. They pack into the last 10 to 15 minutes is very strange how they shoot it, like how much they fit in. Well, we can get into it. Let's get into it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I wanted to say, you know, just talking about that question of like, what's going on here? I mean, Bill, you mentioned that there's like four different kinds of movies, and I was explaining to this film to my wife after I'd seen it. And I said, it starts off, in like golden age Hollywood romance, segues into like inspirational Disney underdog story, becomes a violent hellscape of just blood and murder, and then after the Japanese counterattack that kind of strands Doss alone on top of Hacksaw Ridge, it becomes like a full on horror movie.
It's a
cat and mouse, like. It's like a survival horror movie or video game where it's like, okay, well, you can't pick up a weapon, but you've got like armed patrols of men who want nothing more than to murder you. And then you gotta get these people off the hill. And so it was weird because it went from just overt violence to sudden like pop-up horror terror. And the way that the shift towards the two latter violent movies is that someone's crawling along the battlefield and they're crawling over corpses and there's rats everywhere, and this guy touches what he believes to be a corpse and the guy just sits up screaming his lungs out.
Yep.
And then he is shot in the face and the guy is covered in blood before the next bullet takes off his own head. And I was like, oh, we're just starting now, aren't we? Like,
yeah,
that is a crazy way to bring us in, because I was like, what is this? Like, this is literally like a scene in Seven when they think the guy is dead on the bed and then he grabs someone and starts like wailing. And I was like, what is happening right now? And then you're just bludgeoned for like 20 minutes. And then you think they've done it. And then the Japanese counterattack comes and it becomes like we'd just been talking about. There's a remake, apparently, of Starship Troopers coming. And it felt a lot like that, because this battered battalion is just like suddenly overrun because the Japanese are streaming out of the holes like crazy. And it was just crazy. It's an assaultive, exhausting, like 40 minutes of a film. And then we get to the montage of him. When the movie begins to montage his rescues instead of going through them one by one, I felt like the two sides of the movie were kind of cohering finally, which was good, because I don't know that I could have handled like another 10 minutes of him sneaking around. There's a scene of him in like catacombs.
Yeah.
Just fucking trying to find a way out. And every once in a while, there's a squad of Japanese that walks by.
Yeah.
And it's rough. And you know, Jordan, I think it was you who said that this sometimes hedges close to feeling like propaganda.
Yeah, especially like, or go ahead, you make your point, then I'll say.
Well, I was just going to say, like, it's really hard sometimes to make a movie that doesn't feel like propaganda when the truth backs up what's happening. And that's like the uncomfortable line that any, and I think this is one of the reasons why we prefer our World War II films to be about the European theater, because, you know, there's a point where the people that are the battalion that Doss is in are coming to relieve are talking to them. And it's like, you know, the Japanese are like not afraid of dying. Like they want to, it's like where they get their juice. And it's like, that sounds awful, and I know that that's what a lot of propaganda was about, because that basically, like, the Japanese army was a death cult. But it's true, in a way. Like, that was a real thing. There's a reason that people, even today, still know what a kamikaze fighter was.
Uh-huh.
It's just, maybe it's because a while ago this wouldn't have made anyone bat any eyelashes. But showing, like, the truth of war suddenly feels like a politically incorrect thing.
And it's weird how empathy is like an essential part of war movies now, just because it's just you can't do the us versus them, but it's going to be something that's justifiably criticized.
I wanted to say it made me wonder, like, we here in America love to hate ourselves. We have a lot of national demons that we have to deal with. Many of them are still alive. I would love to know what a nation like Japan goes through in terms of its own introspection related to things like that. Because, mm-hmm. like, if you look up things like, I think it's Unit 731 or, like, the Rape of Nanking,
mm-hmm.
like, they make a lot of the stuff that we did seem like just misguided altruism. And, like,
there's actually an interesting part of Michael Moore's new documentary, Where to Invade Next, that talks about that in relation to Germany. It's very interesting.
Well, I'm more aware of how Germany handles it. I mean, like, they, you know, restricted printing of Mein Kampf and everything, and they seem to handle it sort of well. But I don't know. Like, it just makes me wonder, because, like, it's so hard for me to imagine, especially because I've done some research on World War II, and those people honestly believed that their emperor was like a deity, and mm-hmm. part of him surrendering was having to go out and tell the nation that he's not.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's something that happened in the 1940s, that we had to tell a nation that we had defeated in war, you know, hey, your guy isn't a god. And that just feels really weird to me. And it's something that I felt uncomfortable during this movie until I remembered, like, no, this isn't Mel Gibson exercising some of his well-documented problems. This is, like, something that happened. And maybe he didn't have to focus on it so much. But I think that it thematically plays in, especially towards the end. But it still made me uncomfortable.
I was going to go into Mel Gibson as well, but go ahead.
Okay. Two quick points. First off, did anyone else think that Vince Vaughn was not going to actually be in this war? Like, cuz I guess the way it's kind of set up and the way it's kind of executed, you just feel like, "Oh, okay, he's the drill sergeant, so he's just going to put them into shape and then send them off to war." And I was kind of caught off guard that he was actually in the middle of the shit. And I was just like, oh, yeah, that's right. He's actually going to ship out with them. Oh. So that was one thing that I was kind of caught off guard by, because it seems like most of the time a lot of the drill sergeants are kind of left by the wayside once they get into the shit. But the other thing that I want to mention and I don't know its historical accuracy, and this film has already kind of had some jabs kind of thrown at it for its historical accuracy as far as, like, Dobbs' life and things like that, even though this is apparently even though this is the most accurate depiction that his own flesh and blood has kind of praised. I'm not sure how much of the Japanese waving the white flag, and we are full on into spoilers, right?
Yeah, we're spoiling. Yeah, okay. Real bad.
When the Japanese wave the white flag and then start throwing grenades and doing all that, it really felt to me like, I know a little bit of the Japanese history, especially in the war, and part of it was that the honor system, and he kind of supplants this sequence with them basically waving the white flag and then like trying to kill other people with this other, I guess, general or whatever, performing the ritual sacrifice of suicide.
Yes, and seppuku.
Seppuku. And so I was like, okay, so he's setting up that these people, if they do not accomplish their task, they're so dishonored that they're literally going to take their life, right? That's how dishonored they feel. And they're like, this is my only way to redeem myself is to just kill myself. And he mirrors that with the soldiers basically saying, okay, I'm going to wave the white flag and then you're going to surround me and then I'm going to try and kill a bunch of y'all.
Yeah.
And I just feel like, A, that's inaccurate, like to the point where it's distractingly inaccurate. And even if it was something that actually happened, it's so distracting, I guess, that it just it just feels fucking out of place. I was just like, wait, why would you put this in this film? It feels like everything was just kind of going along and you were like, yes, the Japanese are kind of this crazy mass of just like going at it. And, you know, they're flooding out of these tunnels and everything just kind of rolls and it makes sense. And they don't do anything that's too absurd and crazy. And then this moment with them waving the white flag and then trying to kill a bunch of other soldiers just feels so off based on their kind of historic sense of this honor and things like that. So I don't know how y'all felt about that moment. I don't know if y'all know anything in particular about that sequence, whether it was, you know,
if you'd asked me 10 years ago, I probably could have given you a better answer. Cause like any good American teenager, I was really into World War II. Mm-hmm. I knew more about the crazy stuff the Russians did. than I did about the Japanese, but my understanding is that things like that did happen.
Mm.
Like there was no concept of surrender. In fact, Michael Snydell, on the Slack chat, pointed out what we were talking about. There is a BBC documentary called, Horror in the East, Japan and the Atrocities of World War II. And the second part of this documentary is titled Death Before Surrender.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know, especially in this particular aspect, but I do know that there was no real protocol for giving up, and that uh-huh. was something that went into the decision to drop the atomic bomb.
And they never thought that they were going to lose, right? So why prepare for losing if you never think you're going to lose?
Well, your leader's a god. I mean,
yeah. You know, you're going to
say God is on our side, but they had a living embodiment of that saying, no, we got this. So,
yeah,
you know, if you can die and take one more guy with you, that's fine. But you can't give up because that's not good.
And the atrocities during the prisoner of war camps and things like that are super well documented at this point. But I feel like that situation specifically is removed from the wartime kind of situation that they're very separate for me, at least mentally.
I agree with you just in the fact that, I mean, it got there, but at first it didn't feel like it had much to do with Doss, who's our man who we're following. Mm-hmm. And so to go into that much detail about the Japanese and what they were doing felt really odd to me.
That's what I was going to say, is that, you know, whether it's biographical or not, it's the fact that his cinematic point of view is almost justifying, you know, some of the more, virulent things that people are saying, you know, about the Japanese soldiers. So whether you want to get into historical things, and Brian, you actually just mentioned something I briefly wanted to bring up, is that the weird part about it is we kind of lose Doss for a decent amount of time in, you know, if you want to say, I really actually like your four, your four section theory, Bill. But that third section especially, we lose DOS for a very long time, which is, you know, seems very purposeful in the sense of just conveying the chaos of the battle. But yeah. It is a certain question about what is the purpose of some of these war scenes, you know, not just in terms of, you know, them turning kamikaze or, you know, these scenes that are trying to show the fury of the two sides. There is a weird point where, okay, at what point are we actually losing, you know, the plot of DOS? And I think that's especially relevant in terms of what you guys are talking about in terms of that grenade scene, which is gorgeous visually, but feels very strange in the sense of how we're supposed to view Gibson's own gaze towards the war.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of it has to do now. Obviously, this is a man who's like insanely religious Christian, sure. And I think, can we talk about some of the stuff I wanted to bring up earlier? And I think it really helps. So, yeah, like,
absolutely.
So, I'm glad you're doing it, Jordan, because I really am interested in talking about the religious viewpoint of this film.
Yeah, so, I mean, you see this person going through suffering, and then there's literally a shot, which I almost, that's where it kind of felt almost like a fake movie, where he, after he goes down the first time, it literally looks like he's getting baptized in the water. Then, like, while it was happening, yeah. I couldn't believe, yeah. Like, I was like, okay, this is full-on Gibson. And then there's this shot where before he comes down, like, everyone's looking at him as he walks, and it literally feels like shots from Passion of the Christ as like
his stations.
It's exactly like what would have happened if in reverse, almost like exactly. He's coming down off the cross, and it's like, oh hey, what's up?
Exactly. And then the last shot, which is like literally like he's ascending to heaven almost as he's descending, like the way he shoots that scene with like the Bible in his hand, and like I like couldn't believe it. Like
he's going down like the zip line, and then the camera kind of circles around him, and the last shot, I guess it's hallucinatory or just like an aesthetic choice.
So,
but it's him like hovering above the battlefield, which is not where he is in reality.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I got you now.
Yeah, so I mean, all those touches, obviously, I mean, Gibson makes no, you know, he's not going to cut around corners in terms of doing this, but I literally feel like that's what drew him so much to this story, and in terms of wanting to show the war so violently, I feel like it's very much aligned with his views and stuff on Christianity about a life of suffering and that kind of, you know, ultimate redemption and stuff like that, and sure. It just was, I'm surprised not more. I guess, I haven't read many reviews, but it does seem like a lot of people are talking about that aspect when it was, like, the most obtuse part of the movie to me. Like, it was unavoidable.
It's a major Christian writer. It's either Alyssa Wilkinson or Jeff – oh, shoot. It was at Christianity Today, maybe. There was some a writer who has a strong religious bent who went pretty deep into this, I believe.
Okay, I'll have to read it.
What was their – summation, like, what did they think?
That's a good question, and I wish I remembered.
God damn it.
Sorry, guys.
But I bet you could tell us all about why Westworld sucks.
Brian.
Oh man, that's inside baseball, bro. Okay.
Yeah. Jordan, get us back on track, please.
Yeah, I was gonna say, Jordan, I guess Jordan, since you brought it up, like, was that distracting to you?
I guess, knowing the filmmaker, and this is the type of thing where I actually don't mind it. You know, I mean, you've talked before, especially in Birth of a Nation, like separating the art from the artist. But it depends, obviously, what you're referring to or what the person morally is about. But I actually found it, you know, quite fascinating in this film, just because I think it sets it apart big time from another war movie. And especially, like, you've talked before about how Christian films nowadays, like, they're pretty much made to serve their audience and just be a what's it called, like a calling board or whatever you call it, that a sounding board.
An echo chamber.
For exactly, like, you know, people go and, like, I have, you know, my grandma and stuff will, like, like only watch Christian movies, and it's just every single thing about them is like exactly what she believes, and like she comes away just like feeling great and like and not challenged at all. And
fantastic.
And so it's like, and anytime she brings up one of those movies, I'm like, I literally review movies for a living, and I will never watch one of those just because it opens up nothing new to faith in general or anything. And so when a movie like this comes along where it has that aspect, but it also has Gibson is not cutting corners in the sense of the violence or anything, and I think that adds a great deal to the ultimate things that he's trying to portray. Like, I honestly got emotional and like during the moment where it's cheesy as all hell, but when Doss has to pray before he goes up there and stuff like that, and his whole crew's
like
waiting.
Final shot.
Not the final
assault. What are you waiting for?
And
Doss is praying.
Yeah, and if a movie hits you over the head the entire running time with that, like most Christian films, you're going to be numb by the end. But I feel like Gibson obviously goes, overboard to the extent where it's undeniable what he's trying to say in the end. But throughout the film, I think just because you're so assaulted in other ways by the violence and the action, really feeling like you've gone through what the character would actually experience, I think those themes, those Christian themes and those themes of faith and things like that, which they really, I think, work in the end for me, at least. I don't know.
This is a question I've asked. I don't think I've ever asked it to you, Jordan. Are you religious at all?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Christian. Yeah. I remember when we had a conversation. I think it was Birth of a Nation.
Yeah.
Yeah. I am a practicing Irish Catholic, so it informs a lot of what I do and feel day to day, and how much I hate myself.
I am not from the Catholic background, so I have a little less self-loathing.
If you don't mind me asking, what is your background?
Well, I grew up pre-Methodist, and now it's kind of like a non-denominational. I would
Unitarian?
Say liberal bending, but not like almost like a progressive Christian, you could say, I guess.
Okay, yeah, I got a friend who goes to one of those around here. It's always interesting to me because I don't even like saying Christian, because I feel like whenever I say that, people think I mean like evangelical.
Exactly. Yeah.
They've somehow hijacked the word Christian, which is just the worst thing in my life. So I always love to point out that I'm Catholic, because as if I can get more specific to back myself away from the lunatic fringe of my own general faith, it helps me out. But as a Catholic, it's very rare that I get a film that I feel like really explores faith in God and Christianity in an interesting way. Mm-hmm. Usually.
This definitely does that.
Because like usually it's like a pure flicks, and it's like I don't need to be part of that. That's the type of thing that makes me say I'm Catholic instead of just saying I'm Christian. The only time Catholics ever seem to be in movies is like if it's an exorcism, like or
the
if,
rosary.
If like the main character is an alcoholic and needs to like talk to like a Catholic priest to like confess. And the Catholic priest's only purpose is ever to be like, we just have to strive to be more like God in our lives. And then the person will either take that or leave it. So it's interesting to see a movie like this where it's fairly obvious that faith is a major part of the character's life. But the movie is much more interested in the character than his faith. And it's more interested in how his faith informs his actions rather than letting his actions be an argument for or against faith. Because I'm a Catholic and one of our big things is like, no matter what, killing is wrong. So that leads to all kinds of stuff. But like basically life is sacrosanct and you can never take it. That being said, I nearly joined the army right out of high school. And when I was told that my grades and my SATs and everything could basically hit me right to a non-commissioned officer with a clear path to OCS, I said, no, I want to start as a private in the infantry. My parents were horrified. The recruiter was very confused. And my logic, I thought at the time, was sound. I didn't want to be hated by anyone who I could be leading by thinking that I skipped over something. Mm-hmm. But I had to get comfortable with the idea that I might have to kill someone, which ultimately I think is what led me to not be in the military. But even with all that, during this movie, there were so many times when I was just like, just pick up a gun. Just get a goddamn gun. What is wrong with you?
At some point, they bring up a very specific issue, and it's like, okay, all he has to actually do is shoot a gun during a rifle exercise and show that he's competent, and that's it. And I'm just like, dude, are you serious right now?
Yeah, it's
like it's admirable, but come on, man.
It's a super interesting thing because, and his wife even brings up, like, you know, are you sure this isn't just pride? But you know, he has a bone deep conviction, and he doesn't feel like that conviction should disqualify him from doing the other thing that he wants to do. And in the end, it doesn't, obviously. But it's just interesting. It's interesting that the movie actually takes that tact and actually shows that. Because yeah, I'm a modern Catholic. If I have to violate something in a very abstract way, I don't think there's a problem with that, especially if it helps me do something that I want. Of course, that'll just add to the crushing guilt that I feel every single day of my life for simply being alive. But what else is new?
This is the Film Stage Show, a.k.a. Brian's Confession Hour.
So swerving just a little bit, one thing I do want to mention that I think is very interesting about this film is that he isn't actually using religion as a basis for why he is refusing to do this action. He is using a promise to his religion, right? So he basically came at it as a promise to God that he would never touch a gun. It has nothing to do with I shall not kill or anything like that.
Right, because he could carry a gun and never shoot it, and that would be fine. But he, like you said, he made a personal promise on top of the Sixth Commandment to never touch a gun.
Related to the memory, right? Is that what we're referring to?
The memory of nearly murdering his dad?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do we think about that, by the way?
So
that apparently actually
it's
happened.
Not real. No, what?
Apparently it was his dad and his uncle fighting, not his dad and his mother. But apparently I did some research on this because I wanted to know what was invention and what was not. And
I don't understand the inclusion of that, honestly.
I don't know. It happened. And again, like, you know, anything that happens doesn't have to happen in the movie.
Sure.
But, I think it was a way to again, like, get away from that concept of him as an avatar for a religious belief and to kind of give more, make it more personal instead of just like, oh, this is the military trying to tamp down Christianity. And it's like, no, this is
a specific
Christian guy trying to exist within this structure.
Yeah, and it is interesting that he keeps getting counseled by a lot of the people in his unit. Yeah, and he keeps getting counseled by them and keeps being told, like, hey, I'm religious too. And, like, a lot of these people are like, hey, you know, I specifically Sam Worthington's character, like, full on, like, sets him down and has, like, a conversation about this. And it's interesting because they're all like, hey, I'm religious too, and yet I still pick up a weapon and I want to fight. And he's like, yeah, I get that, but I made a promise. So, like, this is different. And it's just like, wow, like they do a painstaking amount of like explanation of like his own self-guilt and his own like reasoning for this that I think actually follows through in the film. And it becomes something more than just, oh, this guy. And I did think it was pretty interesting that they also have this guy that's kind of a shrink that comes in and is basically like, no, this dude's not crazy. like y'all keep thinking like he's talking to somebody. No, he's just like, and even he, Doss mentions, like, he straight up is like, hey, I know this is like, y'all think I'm having a conversation with God, but literally, like, I say things to God and I don't hear anything back. So I'm not crazy.
One of the weirdest like, conversations you can ever have with someone who's not religious is if you say, like, God told me. Because then their immediate assumption is, oh, great, my friend is schizophrenic.
Sure. Yeah. They're like, oh, this dude's okay. Yeah. Should he be discharged?
I think the one thing about, you know, that scene with Sam Worthington, you know, you get that interesting thing where he's like, you know, we're facing Satan, really? you know, and, you know, I wish the movie did unpack a little bit more about what other people feel. I think we do spend, as you're saying, I think we do a good job of, or the film does a good job of articulating Doss's personal beliefs. But I think there is, at least personally, I did want more of the conflict that other people are going through.
You mean non-religious?
Or? No, not even.
You wanted more time with Smitty?
Not even related to faith.
Hollywood.
Hollywood
is the best. Oh, go ahead.
I feel like some of those conversations, they ended with him. They ended with, Doss and his views without actually making an argument for what other people believed.
Well, I think,
and I understand. I don't know.
I would say this scene.
Yeah, go ahead, Jordan.
Just one scene that was really good was the scene where they're kind of in the hole and they're waiting at night, and it's with him and Luke Bracey's character, Smitty.
Sure.
And when they're discussing, you know, how he, you know, thinks he got him wrong and stuff, and I think almost all the other characters' viewpoints of him and kind of their experience kind of filtered through that, through him, and you can kind of see it. Then it proves true during the scene when you realize how many people he saved, and they all look at him and things like that.
Sure.
And but I understand what you're talking more about, their own personal journey, not exactly in relation to Doss at all.
Bracey's viewpoint, for instance, if he also. Can't remember if Bracey's religious. I think Sam Worthington is the one I brought it up because I think he specifically says he is religious. But I do want more of a sense of what they were going through. Yeah, Jordan, I agree that like the characters do a really good job of why they turn around on Doss. But I'm almost more interested in how they can not only accept Doss, but how they can reconcile that with their own views.
Yeah, I was going to say it would have been interesting to see if like his existence within the company caused any trouble with anyone else being like, hey, can I also not have to kill anyone?
Yeah, or just some other, not even conflict, but friction.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like there was enough time taken on the sort of shallow friction that had been caused that I was fine when they just kind of like said, all right, he won, let's move on.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been interesting, but it would have been a very different movie. Like, that would have been the type of movie that ends with him winning and being able to go to war and then us not having to see the war.
I recognize that.
The pure Flix version.
Yeah. I hate the idea that like this movie could have been done that way. Because I like what it does enough, and I think that it gives enough questions over, and I was wondering like I just keep getting disappointed every time I think of Birth of a Nation with all of the interesting conversations it could have had, and I like what this one did, but I think that it's a much simpler question that it asks and makes Doss answer, because it's a question of, okay, are you gonna kill anyone? And he's like, no. And we intrinsically are like on his side for that. And we also have the hindsight of knowing that we ended up winning World War II. That's not a problem for us. And I think that Birth of a Nation, if it had perhaps used a little bit of the more religiously focused character.
It's thornier.
Yeah. It could have been more interesting and tackled a much more difficult question.
So I want to bring up two things real quick. First thing is, was I the only one that was lost in terms of what happens to the brother?
Yeah, they never really bring him up again.
So he just goes off and that's it?
I'm sure he's fine.
That'll be in the director's cut.
Guys, he's one of the talking heads at the end.
Oh, is he?
I mean,
he is. True. Yeah, but I don't know. It just feels weird that like he's kind of a big part of the beginning, and then he's.
I would agree.
Yeah.
In fact, when the medic from the other company comes in and is like, "Hey, is Doss here? Like, I'm looking for Doss." I was like, "Uh oh." This is where he finds out that his brother was killed, and now he's got to like get over his personal desire for revenge. Mm-hmm. But instead, nothing.
Yeah,
his brother is fine.
Okay, okay, good. I'm glad I didn't miss something in this 2 hour 10 minute film.
You and your fixation on movie times.
It is what it is.
Fair enough.
We were talking a lot about religion, and I wanted to intercede, and I couldn't find a moment, and now I've completely drawn a blank as far as what I was going to talk about. So that was a long-winded way of saying move on.
I forgot my next point.
I will say it was the article you were referencing, Michael, earlier. It's from Brett McCracken, who actually is a big fan of the film stage and a big Malick fan, but it's on Christianity Today, and I was just skimming through it, and it is very interesting. It just talks about how in most Hollywood films, like if there's a question of a character who has faith, it's very much like his in a normal Hollywood arc, his faith would be lost and then he would regain it, whereas it's rare to see a movie where it's kind of throughout there and it's
There's no crisis. There's no rejecting the call.
That's a great point.
Like this is a guy who just wants to do right.
Good point is where he talks about how in the Bible it says like faith without works is dead, and so in this movie how his faith is very much front and center and not private kind of interesting.
Well, that's one of my biggest complaints about most fucking pure flicks movies is like there's never any internal conflict,
right?
It's
yeah.
always this person just shouting against the Goliath of secular life, and yeah. this one you can tell that there is personal conflict, and he's fighting hard against a group of people who want to understand him and want him to be there as long as he's going to do his damn job, which he does. In fact, one of the interesting things that I read was that no one's entirely sure how many people he saved, because he said, I think I saved like 50 people, and the army's like, no man, you saved 100.
I thought it was 75.
And he's like, and he says, no, like I'm pretty sure I only saved 50, and the army's just like, okay, well we're damn sure that you saved 100. And he's like, I can't take credit for that, because he's just so goddamn humble. And so they finally are like, well, how does 75 sound? And he's like, okay, fine.
I actually don't understand. Like, it was actually blew my mind when he was doing that, how like he snuck around and was able to do that. Like, it felt like the Japanese forces just kind of gave up and no one was on watch or something, because like you would be able to see 75 bodies be removed.
I think if I had to knock this movie, I think it's what's the word I'm looking for? Its establishment of geography was very off, because it really seemed like they had climbed up onto like a mesa in Monument Valley.
Yeah.
And like that's not at all what it is. Like that's a ridge that leads to the entire island basically. So I think there's like enough space, and the Japanese saw a full on retreat that they maybe lowered their guard a little bit because they assumed everyone was gone. But I was fine with that. I loved the scene where, like I said, they just decide to montage it, and he consistently, after every person takes like 2 minutes to catch his breath and say like, please God, let me get one more. And he apparently said that 74 to 100 times.
Yeah. That was the part I was referencing earlier, where it did feel a little strange to have the only point of view we ever get from the Japanese be through a montage. And so, I mean, I understand, because Gibson is obviously coming at this from a very pro-America side, you could say. And so, but that was a little disappointing. I felt like it could have been even more intense if we did get, like you said, a better sense of the geography, a better sense of what the Japanese were thinking and going through beforehand. But then again, it might have taken away from Garfield's point of view. So I don't know. I don't know how you strike a balance.
But letters from Iwo Jima for.
Yeah,
sure.
It's funny because the way this movie ends is like with like a...
Wait,
2-minute documentary.
Bill's been trying to say something.
Oh, okay. Bill? Did you remember your point?
You. Yes. Yes. Oh. Yes, I did, actually. So, that's why
there.
I wanted to intercede. Okay. All right. So one thing I think is really interesting about this film is for most of the advertisements, we basically know that this guy is a medic, that he actually succeeded in what he was trying to attempt, and, you know, it actually ends up on the battlefield. But the thing is that the film never treats it like the certainty. And I felt like that was such a key part for why this film, I mean, look, in the middle of it, it has like a wartime tribunal and you're just like, whoa, holy shit. They're really selling the fact that like, no, we're not just going to skip over this, right? We're not just going to, we're not going to Doctor Strange and like fast forward like, 3 months, right? Like he's not just going to go from the believer to the, or the non-believer to the believer, right? So they don't, they do such a good job of selling you, because it would be so easy for DOS in this moment to basically be criticized and ridiculed and be like, dude, you don't know what the fuck you're doing. Like you're going over there and you're not going to have a weapon and you're going to die in like a minute, which was actually kind of what happened to a lot of people over there. Right.
Even
like
they did
like
have a gun.
Like we put a lot of like training and money behind this. And then we send them over there and then they get killed in a minute. And you're like, well, shit, like that was our best soldier. And he just died. Okay. You like go. But so they do such a good job of like selling his kind of stakes here, because they're they don't ever like give you a moment where they're like, hey, let like DOS doesn't ever tell them like a way for them to understand what he is trying to do. It is completely abstract for him. It is completely abstract for them. It's completely abstract for everybody except for the audience that knows that he is kind of this celebrated war hero, right? So in the reality of the film, they do such a good job of, they're just like, hey, DOS doesn't know what the fuck he's going to do when he gets over there either. Like he may just die in the first minute, or he may save 75 people. We just don't know. And they never give him that kind of ammunition where he's like, hey, guys, so I want to go over there. I want to be a medic and I'm going to run around and save people while like either gunfire is going on or not. But mainly when gunfire isn't, and I'm going to be kind of this sneaky stealth like medic and I'm just going to pull people out. And like they never give him that ammunition. And yet you as the audience knows it, and it's kind of maddening, but it's kind of refreshing at the same time, because you're just like, why don't you just tell them you're going to save 75 people and they'll just let you go over there? Right? You know, so I don't know. I don't know if y'all kind of observed that at the same time, but that was one thing that I was kind of struck by, was like they really went out of their way to kind of sell this as like, dude, nobody knows what you're going to go over there and do.
You definitely you definitely feel the randomness.
It's very interesting too, that scene where he kicks the grenades, you know, like the most like acrobatic, you know, part of the movie.
He does like a pirouette.
He slaps one and then kicks the other one and then is exploded into a spin. You know, okay.
Yeah.
You want to know
what's
crazy?
And that's in the trailer, and there's nothing else like that in the movie, which is, you know, kind of great. Which is exactly what you're getting into, Bill, is the sense of like you have no sense of what he's going to do, and there is the genuine possibility that, you know what, maybe he could get clipped immediately.
Yeah.
Like I kind of thought he could die.
I was expecting him to die, in all honesty. they give out these things posthumously, and what's better than a like, what's better for a Christ-like story than for the person to literally die?
Sure,
that's not untrue.
But one of the things I wanted to bring up was so you know how a lot of times like they'll change things to make a story more dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
Reading through his citation for the Medal of Honor, it seems like they maybe scaled back a bit on things that he did in order to make it less spectacular.
For the first time in history.
Well, Audie Murphy, I think was his name, was one of the most decorated soldiers of all time. And when he came to Hollywood to make his own movie, you know, Hollywood was like, all right, everyone loves us. We just won World War II. We want to make a movie about Audie Murphy. And he kept telling them, like, oh, we can't have that. No one's going to believe that. But apparently, yeah. like, they did that for this, too, because I was like, there's no way that the cliff was that high. And looking at this, it says, Private First Class Doss was a company aid man when the 1st Battalion assaulted a jagged escarpment 400 feet high. Okay.
What? Jesus.
And then...
yeah, maybe that's not tall enough.
I was about to say, I don't think that the thing in the movie was that tall. So, what we have here at the end is fearlessly risking the chance of being mistaken for illustrating Japanese, giving aid to an injured man until he himself was seriously wounded in the legs by the explosion of a grenade. Rather than call another aid man from cover, he cared for his own injuries and waited 5 hours before litter bearers reached him and started carrying him to cover.
You fucking Boy Scout.
The trio was caught in an enemy tank attack, and PFC Doss, seeing a more critically wounded man nearby, crawled off the litter and directed the litter bearers to give their first attention to the other man. Awaiting the litter bearers' return, he was again struck by a sniper bullet while being carried off the field by a comrade, this time suffering a compound fracture in one arm. With magnificent fortitude, he bounded a rifle stock to his shattered arm as a splint, wow. then crawled 300 yards over rough terrain to the aid station.
Wait, you're telling me Mel did not put that in there?
He did not put that in there. No wonder
the film feels so abrupt and like how it ends, because I guarantee you he filmed that.
Another hour.
No, he filmed that and someone was like, no, dude.
He did say in interviews where he said there was just stuff that was too ridiculous to even no one would believe it. So
yeah, I mean it's funny because like yeah he like you've got him using the rifle to carry Vince Vaughn off, but then it's like if you were to have him use a broken rifle to splint his own arm, like no, that's just too much. So I wanted to point that out.
It is like the Inglourious Basterds propaganda movie, but for us, it's kind of crazy.
Well, it's interesting that like it's the rare war movie that isn't like, oh, this is a guy who was peace loving but like took up arms to defend his country. It's like, no, this is a guy who was peace loving who wanted to do what little he could to like maintain humanity and civility in a terrible, terrible time. And I think that's a laudable goal, especially because it still manages some nuance about, you know, faith and country.
For sure.
400-foot escarpment. That it does.
Well, how do we do? Are we guys happy Gibson is back then, and maybe we'll make another movie soon?
I don't know. It's hard because
unfortunately he's doing Resurrection next, which is I just wish he would do another more interesting story. But
yeah, I think
Titanic 2.
It's totally Bill. I mean, we've talked a little bit about like what keeps us away from an artist, and I didn't want to get into it again on this, but I mean like Johnny Depp has already been cast in like future Beasts of the Southern Wild, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them films.
Fantastic Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Yeah, that is a great crossover.
Hold on. Oh yeah. I'm sorry. I was about to say, I thought for a second there, I was confusing Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them with Dr. Strange for some reason. I thought, wait, is he Dormammu? And I was like, wait. And so, yeah, I forgot. Yeah, sorry.
No, different wizards. But, like, I don't know. It's really hard because I'm a fan of an underdog story and someone coming back from, you know, disgrace of their own making to do something. I don't know what should be expected of him in terms of a mea culpa, but I think that this is a good way to come back without selling out.
I was already sold. Interesting. I was sold with his performance in Bloodfather already, so I'm ready.
All right.
I think the thing that's weird about it too, you know, to go to like, you know, the triumvirate of problematic people, you know, Roman Polanski and Woody Allen, you know, they're also like Mel Gibson, like people who keep repeating their demons and bringing them into their own films. And It is really hard. I guess Roman Polanski, I mean, is slightly easier than Woody Allen, but you know, it's hard when Mel Gibson keeps doing these films about justified reconciliations. Like, it's just it splits my brain in two.
Reconciliations?
I would say reconciliations. You know, repeated apologies that have this sanctimony and holiness to them.
Justification for
forgiveness. Yeah.
Yeah, justification in it. Like, you know, Apocalypto.
I don't know. I don't see a lot of.
Maybe not Apocalypto. It's been a bit since Apocalypto, so I'm not sure about that one. But
people with repellent ideas, to me, are easier to forgive than people who have done monstrous things. I don't know the full breadth of Mel Gibson's monstrousness coming off. I know about the police pulling him over and all of the terrible things he said about Jewish people. Was he? I know that he said awful things to a girlfriend, but did he hit her? Like, is that something that happened?
Does it matter?
To me, it kind of does. Like,
What?
To me, a person can have, like, we're living in a world where this concept of implicit bias is becoming more well known, and I think that a person can have that within them and then struggle against it and overcome it. But for me, for some reason, whenever you cross into the realm of the physical, when you let that escape your mental headspace and become an action of violence towards another person, like, that's where it starts to get harder for me to handle it. So Roman Polanski, Woody Allen, you know, people like that, it's going to be harder for me to get over it.
But you're starting to weigh more morality there, and I feel like that's
an impossible Maybe thing to do, but
my own ideals are slipping into this. I'm not going to pretend they're not. I just that conversation makes me uncomfortable when we start, you know. Going back to justification, that becomes a lot more difficult.
Right. Well, I'm not justifying anything I did. I mean, it's horrible, but for me,
rationalization.
I'm just saying, like, I'm not going to forgive Mel Gibson for the things that he said. Not that it would matter if I did or not, because he'll never know me, and my opinion will never sway anyone else's thinking. Probably, I'm being very humble. But if it comes down to it, I'm going to forgive the guy who I think, you know, may think horrible things, but is actively striving to suppress them and, like, be better than them, than the man who hit his fucking wife.
Sure.
Like, that's just how I am. Because I, as much of a, you know, in Christianity, there's a concept of, like, if you sin in your heart, you've sinned. That's it. But I'm not about to hold everyone's brains and inner thoughts to the level of that. Like, you have thoughts that you can't control. And if you start to let those things jumble inside you too much, it's going to drive you nuts. And, you know, it's messed up. No matter how drunk you got me, you could not get me to say the things that Mel Gibson said. It's just not in my heart. It's not in my spirit. But I think that it's easier for a person to wrestle with demons inside of them than to come back from having harmed another human being physically.
Sure.
That's just where
sounds like a great roundtable episode.
Yeah. Well, Jordan, you'd ask, like, are we happy Mel Gibson is back? Like, I don't know that I'm happy he's back. I don't know that I'm happy that we seem to have forgiven him to the point where he can make a movie of this scale. But I know that I like the movie. And
I come from the point of view where if a director, I mean, people vote with their dollars. And if a director, if their movies continue to make money, there's obviously an audience for it. There's off, you know, like, I don't know. Because it feels like with Birth of a Nation, it kind of tanked and it seems not, like,
relevant anymore.
Yeah, so to speak. Whereas, I don't know. It's difficult for sure.
Yeah.
But
there's such an interesting conversation to be had about the similarities and what what this does right, and especially how Birth of a Nation feels like a template.
A Braveheart.
especially Braveheart, but of this as well in terms of its...
Mel Gibson even advised Nate Parker on the movie.
Sure, yeah.
Well,
great double feature.
We are doing a roundtable this week, so we'll maybe we can work that in. Because I know we talked about separating art from artist, and it had to do with the accusations against Johnny Depp. I don't think we ever got into... I don't think we ever got into, like, horrible things that people say. I think we were pretty much talking about...
We talked about Nate Parker a decent amount on The Birth of the Nation episode.
You guys should do the best political movies.
Oh, God.
It could be very depressing.
Or maybe
the best apocalyptic movies, depending on who wins.
I was going to say, like, best movies about, like, faith or religion might be good, but I don't know. Yeah. It's because, again, like, those are few and far between.
Yeah. Well, anyways.
Yeah, but I would say Hacksaw Ridge. I mean, we got away from it, but I don't want people to forget. This movie has a tonal shift that'll break your brain, and you should be prepared for it.
Just like life, Brian.
Yeah, life does have tonal shifts that'll
break your brain. Tonal shift that'll break your brain. Cool.
As a new father, I can say tonal shifts that'll break your brain all over the place. So I say this is a fine movie, and people should see it. I can't make a judgment about whether or not you want to forgive Mel Gibson and give him your money. But if you are the type of person who feels you can, then go for it.
We're sorry if you listen to this podcast for only that answer.
Yeah. Oh man, I was really hoping they'd talk about Mel Gibson's latent anti-Semitism more.
Maybe the next film.
Saying that. Yeah. Maybe the round table. But yeah, that's it. Does anyone think people should not see this? It feels like we're all pretty positive.
I am mixed, but I would absolutely recommend people seeing this for the second half.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah, I would agree.
All right. Well, that's it for today. Again, we are brought to you by Mubi, the curated streaming online cinema. Go to mubi.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial of the finest curated gems of independent and foreign and all around wonderful films online. I was gonna say something, but now I can't even remember what it was.
I watched
a movie the other day, and I can't remember which one it was. Yes, Jordan,
what were you gonna say, Jordan?
Well, it is Noirvember.
So. Oh yes, my motherfucker!
I don't know
God.
If any of those. I guess in. I'm trying to look at their lineup. I don't know if any really qualify, but I'm sure they'll have some.
I don't think that I'm not sure that any of the Noirvember ones have come up. The last two appear to have been Johnny Toe films.
I hope they have like Les Samurai or something.
I actually own that on Blu-ray, so but hey, you can get it up anyway.
Yeah.
All right.
Go see. Well, I was going to say for the next review, Arrival is getting a wide release next weekend.
Yes. Yeah. We had a Twitter follower who was like, "Why don't you tell us what to go see?" And I was like, "We used to do that. I guess we've been forgetting."
I guess it's hard because there was a stretch where it was a lot of limited releases that.
Yeah, and we didn't know when I would get certain things.
Yeah,
Owl comes out next week too, and it's absolutely worth a watch if you can stomach it.
What was it?
Yeah,
Owl.
Yeah, Paul Verhoeven's movie.
Oh,
Isabelle Huppert. Yeah,
ELLE. Okay. We're going to be talking about Arrival. I might take 10 seconds to plug The Monster, which is also coming out in limited release next week. From
have you not already?
No, well, it's only on DirecTV. I wrote a review for my personal site.
And you mentioned it in the last roundtable briefly.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, I think you've mentioned this a couple of times by now.
Only because I was segueing into talking about The Strangers by Brian Bertino, but now I can actually talk about The Monster and two of the best performances you will see in a film this year. So that's your teaser.
Speaking of Isabelle Huppert.
Yeah. Isabelle Huppert and Elle is like off the chain. Oh, it's like insane.
But if you wanna see the movie that we're going to be giving our full length review to, that will be Arrival, the newest film by Denis Villeneuve.
Someone see Elle so we can talk about it. Actually,
fucking, I'll try
that one deserves a full episode though. You should wait till it expands. Yeah.
Yes,
we'll see we'll it. Do Don't worry, we'll Michael. We'll get to it.
Okay. All right. So that is that. I can't think of anything else to say. So let's tell the fine people where you can be found at home. Jordan Raup.
JP Raup on Twitter and then on the film stage. And I will say one thing really quickly. If you guys, I know a lot of our listeners are very attuned to movies, hopefully, and wanting to see everything that comes out this year. So I did a feature called Where to Stream the Best Films of 2016 that I'm constantly updating. So
yeah.
There's like 50 films that I would at least that I would recommend that I put on there.
Nice.
What movie?
Is Triple Nine on there?
Oh my God.
God, no, it's not.
yes.
And yes, yeah, you can check it out. But if you do have suggestions that aren't Triple Nine, you can at me on Twitter and I can I'll watch it and then see if it passes my high standards. And
that's all right. If anyone wants to see Triple Nine, you can borrow my copy. Hit me up. Anyway, oh, Michael Snydell.
You got another Triple Nine conversation, and I can't believe you.
Every goddamn week.
You can find me on Twitter at Snydell, talking about why I'm conflicted about problematic anti-Semitists.
And read your reviews from Chicago International.
Are there any non-problematic anti-Semites? Is that really a...
That's a good point. All right, you know what? Brian, you're ruining my thing again. All right. So anyway, I also have reviews from the Chicago International Film Festival at the wonderful film stage. So I have reviews for The Happiest Day in the Life of Ali Mackey, which is should be on Mubi, I have to think, relatively
soon. Not yet,
soon.
But next year probably.
Okay.
That is Ali Mackey, right? That's not a follow-up movie to The Secret Life of Alex Mack.
You have already made this joke, Brian.
I'm going to keep making it.
All right. Also, in things that aren't derailing the podcast, and then I also reviewed 154, which is a new film with Antoine Olivier Pilmont from Mommy. And finally, the big recommendation is for Raoul Peck's documentary, I Am Not Your Negro. So you can read all those reviews on the film stage.
Ah, I just got that in a screener.
Cool. It's great.
Yeah, Magnolia's pushing it, thankfully. For everyone else, it comes out February 3rd.
All right, Bill Graham.
You can find me doing research on Doss's brother, figuring out what the hell happened to him, on Twitter, at CableBFG. You can also find me writing for The Film Stage and FreshFiction.tv, and I should have that interview up with Trevante Rhodes for Moonlight sometime next week.
Fantastic. And you can find me tweeting about, I don't know, I was going to say God and religion, but that just sounds awful, so I'll never do that.
God's not dead?
One of these days I'm going to watch those movies just so I can hate them with more reason. Nah, I have reason enough. They exist. So you can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. You can find my personal site, dearfilm.net, where I'm going to start trying to write some reviews for some stuff that we can't talk about here. And sooner or later, someday, perhaps, maybe, I will have a review up with Joe Carnahan. But we keep having some issues with scheduling. So maybe one day soon, but I can't make any promises. That is all for today, ladies and gentlemen. Again, join us next week when we'll be talking about Arrival. Until then, thank you so much for joining us. Have a great week. I see the color.